This week we learned that when Marvel throws a party, a lot of people pay attention. We also learned that if you release a teaser image of a purple guy wearing gaudy jewelry, comic book fans lose their minds. Let's start the show.
Smithy Memorial Studio. This is the Broken Projector Podcast with Scott Beggs and Jeff Latula.
Welcome everyone to another surreptitious episode of the Broken Projector Movie Podcast. I am your host, Scott Beggs. Jeff Latula is on assignment in Djibouti. And because of that, we are bringing on an honored guest, someone I am really happy to have on, who you all know. He needs no introduction, which makes, I guess, the last 20 seconds of this kind of pointless, but Eric D. Snyder. Sir, welcome on.
Thanks for having me, or having me back. Have I been on this show before?
I don't know. Who knows?
I was on the other one when it had a different name.
Yes. So it technically the same. I like to think of this as a different name, different format, but same show.
Right, right. Well, it's good to be back, and it's good to be here on a time when Jeff is not.
Are you rivals? Do you not like each other?
No. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Of course, people can hear you on Movie BS with Bear and Snyder, where you play Snyder.
That's right, I do. And Jeff Bear plays Jeff, a different Jeff.
And I was actually really happy to meet him for the first time at Fantastic Fest. We've talked on Twitter and all that sort of thing. And
yeah.
Finally met him in person, where you made him wear a shirt because he lost a bet. And I would like for you to describe this T-shirt to our listeners.
This T-shirt, he lost a bet, and so he had to wear a shirt that I designed for a day. And on the front, it said, in big letters, it said, "I am sexually attracted to Eric D. Snyder."
Right.
And then there was a picture of me waving and saying hello with my shirt off.
Just in case no one, in case someone.
So people know who Eric D. Snyder was. Yeah. And then on the back, it said, "My name is Jeff Bear. I like poop."
Yeah. Which is that accurate or is this?
Yeah, actually, that everything on that shirt, I got straight from his diary. So.
It's old entries. I'll point out also that Jeff Bear is about 8 feet tall, and you got him an extra small t-shirt.
Yeah, it's actually only a size medium. I could have gone smaller on the shirt.
Yeah, but I say extra small so that people really get the view. I mean, that's not factually
really
accurate,
but it's an inaccurate view. So you can really have an inaccurate picture of what it looked like.
But it's more it's more emotionally correct. It's not.
But it's emotionally correct, yeah.
It's imaginatively correct.
And your regular co-host, Jeff Latulip, was once on Movie BS with Bear and Snyder with me and Bear.
This is an incestual world that we've got going on.
Yep,
but,
pretty much.
But y'all's podcast is very, very funny, and it's far more popular than ours.
I don't know if that's true.
I think so.
I agree it's funnier. I don't know if it's more popular, though.
Very nice. That's a good start. thanks for coming on. And also, will you tell us where all we can find your writing at this point?
I'm on Twitter at Eric D. Snyder, and then I write some stuff for Complex.com and some stuff for Geek Nation. And MovieBS.com is where you'll find our podcast, which is also hosted by Geek Nation.
And I'll also point out it's S-N-I-D-E-R.
Yes, it is.
S-N-Y or S-N-E-I.
Yeah. Any of those. Don't get it wrong, like some of the people who write checks to me.
Don't do it. So at the top of the hour here, we do have a really fun show for you this week, even with Jeff out. We've got an extended interview that's a very candid interview, I will say, with Adi Shankar, the producer of Dread and The Gray and several other R-rated films. He is a very candid guy. He speaks his mind, so get ready for that. And in the meantime, I have a special segment for you in particular, Eric D. Snyder.
Okay.
Coming up in a bit. But at the top, we wanted to go last week. We talked about characters who were pushed to their limits and kind of explored characters who, whether externally or internally, had been had themselves broken by the end of a film. And we explored a little bit about how to craft that, how to create that, and what that ends up looking like on screen, and kind of talked about our favorites. And we asked you to share yours, and here is what you shared with us. On Twitter, Critical Bill, user at WilliamRankin83, said, "Michael Douglas in The Game has everything stripped away little by little until he has to confront the suicide of his father. And he also has to hang out with Sean Penn."
That's part of the... nobody enjoys that.
It's true. It's actually part of the deal. And I wonder if Critical Bill, you know me through my writing, because I just lose it for David Fincher all over the place. And The Game is one of my favorites. I like people who lie in
the writing. I love the game. I love the game.
And I recently found out that there are people who don't like it.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
It doesn't. It really doesn't. Have your opinions, people, but
yeah,
have the right ones.
Come on. Exactly.
Yeah. And on the post itself, in our comment section, user Kyle said, "What about Bob?" Which it's got to be the greatest. I feel like the game and What About Bob has to be a double feature at some point.
I recently rewatched What About Bob for the first time in 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Like everyone, I think, is that.
Yeah. And I didn't like it then, and I don't like it now, as much as I love Bill Murray. I don't think it's very funny. And it's like a horror movie. It's the plot of a horror movie, but they're trying to play it for laughs. But I agree with Richard Dreyfuss. Bob's annoying.
He is. No, I mean, he's
supposed to be. Get him out of here. But he's not. But not like in a fun, funny way. It's like, yeah, kill this guy.
That's what I actually really appreciate about the movie, though, is because if you read it in a certain way, then Richard Dreyfuss's character is actually, I mean, it's like Diary of a Madman. So it's like, why does everyone find Bill Murray charming in that movie?
Well, exactly. And it's frustrating.
But you do side with, I mean, this is like Office level humor before The Office was really coming.
But I feel like the movie wants us to be on Bill Murray's side and be like, oh, come on, don't be such a grump, Richard Dreyfuss.
Yeah.
Come on, he's just having fun.
Yeah. Except no, he's horrifying.
Is awful, yeah.
And he knows your home address.
He does. I mean, not mine, but he knows.
No, he knows. Bill Murray knows your home address as well.
I hope he calls first.
And then another user commenter, I am Honey Boo Boo, which I'm really hoping this is the genuine article here, mentioned Bruce Banner. I don't know why that would have flipped us. I feel because like Bruce Banner isn't just like tormented throughout the entire movie, but Bruce Banner's like, minute five, you've reached your limit.
Then he stops being Bruce Banner and is somebody else.
Yes. So do you not want to spoil it for people?
I don't want to spoil it, but yeah, he just sort of, you know,
that was really
in a way
you
could say he sort of becomes another character almost, as it were, just saying.
First, well, don't we all? It's the duality, our Jekyll and Hyde nature. And then I actually joked about it in the post itself, but we didn't mention Old Boy during the show at all, and I just thought about it while I was writing up the post and thought, wow, we are dumb. Very dumb. So thanks for writing in. Again, if you have comments, concerns, questions, if you're outraged, please Twitter us at Broken Projector, email us podcast@filmschoolrejects.com, and you can go to brokenprojectorpodcast.com and click on the little question mark, and we will have Jeff LaTulip answer your screenwriting questions on the show whenever he gets back from Djibouti. And now, Eric, are you prepared for your special segment?
I'm not wearing pants. Am I on the right track?
So you're prepared. Why is that the go-to gag for podcasting? Not doing it in pants.
Who said anything about a gag?
I'm proud to say I am in pants. I defy logic. I'm wearing pants currently.
Yeah, I don't know what this segment is, but I guess I'm prepared.
I worry that people who listen to podcasts just assume all of us are just nude doing it, because we can.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, if you're just by yourself in your house.
Mm-hmm. But that's how I feel about listening to NPR, too.
They're nude.
Like, they're not on TV, so Steve Inskeep is probably just buck ass.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, for sure.
Right.
Terry Gross has not worn a skirt in, like, 15 years.
Why would you? If you had the freedom.
Exactly.
Why would you?
Exactly.
Okay, so this is... We have Adi Shankar talking about R-rated movies a little bit later. It is Halloween, and it seemed appropriate to talk about horror movies of some kind.
Wait, slow down. How do you figure?
Because it's thematic, it's topical. Yeah.
All right.
We'll let you work through it. But are you a horror fan? Mild, medium. What's the scale of 1 to 10 on you?
Yeah. I mean, I don't specialize, but I do like horror movies when they're good.
You're not like Scott Weinberg.
No, I'm not. No, I'm no Scott Weinberg. I'm no Brian Collins. Mm-hmm. No, Charles Manson. But I enjoy them, and I've seen a lot of them.
Yes. Okay. So you are probably appropriately prepared then, because I would like to quiz you on some horror movies.
Am I allowed to cheat?
Sure.
Okay.
Who's going to know? You're not wearing any pants.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. You can write the answers on your leg or something. you mean use the internet. Okay, that seems simple.
Yeah, that's what I meant, yes.
So question one, quiz question. What horror villain is known as the bastard son of 1,000 maniacs?
That's Freddy Krueger.
That's a good, immediately. Well done.
Yeah.
Do you like those movies?
I just... I actually just rewatched the first one last night, and I haven't seen the others.
To see Johnny, Johnny Depp get killed.
Yeah, see Johnny Depp wearing a belly T-shirt. He's wearing the same kind of shirt that Bill is wearing in Bill and Ted.
Yeah,
that stops above his navel. It's a ridiculous look.
Well, I think a lot of people wore that at the time, or I assume so.
I guess so. As was the style at the time.
I was born in '84, and so I didn't really live through the '80s so much as I I had my childhood. My rearing was in the '80s.
Right, so that's where you were reared.
Yeah. Okay. I could have worded that better, maybe.
I was reared in the '80s once or twice.
Okay. Well, that's a personal choice. That's a personal choice, and you're.
But I haven't seen any of the Elm Street sequels in many years. My recollection is not being terribly impressed with any of them.
Yeah, although Dream Warriors I remember enjoying quite a bit. It's a girl who gets turned into a cockroach at some point. Sure. I remember watching one late at night, and I don't remember which one it is at all, but a girl was in like a high chair for babies, but it was obviously adult-sized high chair.
Right.
And they were just stuffing what seemed to be like internal organs and like force feeding them to her until she died in the dream.
Yes. I remember that.
And I remember maybe this is a feather in the cap of the movie, but I remember thinking, nope, like not going to finish. I'm not going to watch this anymore. Like I was, at the time, my threshold was lower, I suppose. But, so
there you go.
And now I've seen.
Yes.
Now I've seen Charlotte Gainsbourg give herself an abortion. So the times have changed.
Wow. Was that in a movie?
Yeah, in Nymphomaniac.
Oh, that's right.
Spoiler alert, she turns into the Hulk.
Wow.
So, okay, question two. What amazing thing happened to Michael Myers in the third Halloween movie?
What amazing thing? And he's not in the third Halloween movie.
That's it. That's correct. That's it. He is not in it at all. And
bit of a trick question there. Nice going.
I told you that's going to be a little bit hard. But
you would have gotten me if I were an idiot.
Well, we still have some chances. So
yeah, there's still plenty of time.
my follow up question is this: can you imagine something like that happening today?
That is such a weird thing that Halloween 3. And I don't think it has defenders. I think it's a terrible movie, even apart from not being part of the Michael Myers story. It's just a dumb movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's hard to imagine. Like if they did, like what would be the equivalent? Like if they did. Like if the third Taken movie wasn't Liam Neeson, but just about like some other random person who got somebody taken from them or something. Yeah,
I mean, I could see that in a kind of Bourne Legacy sort of way.
Yeah, I guess. But yeah,
it would be almost like
a Batman movie without Batman.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was almost gonna say it'd be like doing Saw without Jigsaw, but they've started doing that too, and it was. I mean, they ran with that, and it was awful. Yeah.
Although even after he died, he still kept being in the movies because they kept having flashbacks and stuff.
Yeah. I guess.
Yeah, it's very strange thing to do.
But when I thought about it, I was like, oh, it's really, I don't think that they would dare do that now. And then I realized, I guess, that we have a little, and the quality has proven itself out.
Well, yeah, yeah.
But it really is like, I think you're onto that in the kind of, intellectual property kind of way where it's like the third Thor movie does not have Thor in it.
Yeah. You wouldn't even like, why would you even try to do that? What's even the advantage to, why would you even try?
Yeah. I don't know. But
yeah. The 80s were a different time.
They were. People were wearing belly shirts back then, I hear.
Poor Ejemplo.
Third question. Do you know what's special about the name or the title Scary Movie?
Scary Movie, it was originally what they were going to call Scream.
You're dynamite on this.
I'm doing great so far. Yeah.
You really are. Follow-up question. What's better, Scream or Scary Movie?
Ooh, well, I mean, Scream is better. Scary Movie is pretty good, though. The first one, pretty funny.
See, it's always funny. I think that the dilution of where we've gone with spoof humor and the like haunted house, I think it's called A Haunted House.
Mm-hmm. There's two of them now.
And Scary Movie 9 with the same, I will say, kind of satirically brilliant, the same diminishing returns that normal horror movies have.
Yeah, kind of. I guess it makes sense that the fifth sequel in the spoof series would be really bad, like the fifth sequel in a horror series.
It's a nice excuse.
Suppose. Yeah, there you go. We're just being true to the franchise. The fifth one's always terrible.
It's nice. We're going to get better on the sixth. It's going to be reboot, new energy, and new life.
Yep.
But it's nice to remember that the original Scary Movie was really, I thought it was a really funny film. Anna Faris.
It was very fun. Yeah.
It was great in it. That was kind of her like moment in the sun.
And it was super dirty. The first two were super dirty, and they were PG-13 after that. But that first one I remember being profoundly obscene.
You know, I recently heard, and you're totally right, I recently read a Clive Barker quote about how he thought that the idea of PG-13 horror was oxymoron. That didn't make sense. why you would limit yourself that way.
I can see that point of view, yeah.
He also called himself a twisted fuck.
Well, well, I guess he would know.
So he only made like 3 movies.
Is that right? I guess that's true. Yeah.
It's bizarre because I think of Clive Barker. I mean, I didn't read a lot of his books. So for me, it's like, oh, Hellraiser. Yes, Clive Barker. And then you realize he really did not make many movies at all.
Yeah, he didn't. And I just watched Hellraiser for the first time a couple weeks ago. I'd never seen it before.
I feel like you've been on a spree of rewatching.
I've been trying to catch up with some things that I'd missed. Yeah.
Yeah.
The only thing about Hellraiser is the main woman in it looks like Jimmy Fallon in drag. She really does.
Doesn't she?
Yeah.
What do you think about it, watching it so many years removed with no nostalgia?
I really liked it. I didn't really know anything about it. You know, of course, I'd seen the image of the pinhead guy.
Right.
But I didn't know the story at all. And I liked it. It's certainly not your typical standard formula plot for a horror movie.
No, it's not.
No, it's not. So, yeah, no, I like the creativity. I enjoyed it.
Were you surprised at all, you know, when not just this, because I feel like Pinhead becomes like the mascot for these movies, but
right. There
are other Cenobites in it.
He's just one of the ensemble.
Yeah.
Which sort of surprised me, but then when I thought about it, it sort of didn't surprise me because that seems like that's how that always goes. That one in the sequel, something will emerge that wasn't that way in the first one.
Right, right.
But yeah, no, that was interesting.
Next question. I don't know what number we're on, so we're just abandoning that.
All right.
So who plays? I'm gonna describe this character. His name is Millard Findlemeyer. He's a killer.
Okay.
He's a killer, and he's sent away. Justice prevails, and he's killed. But mm-hmm. the government kills him. And his ashes are sent to his mother, who is a witch.
Sure.
Who bakes him into the
the ginger dead man?
I haven't finished yet. But yeah, the ginger dead man.
Okay.
Who plays Millard Findlemeyer and voices the ginger dead man?
Ooh, I have not seen that movie, but let me see if I remember. I'm not cheating. I could be talking while I'm cheating, like I'm Googling, but I'm actually not. You have my word.
As a
journalist, I'm not cheating. Because I want to say it's someone like Wallace Shawn. Is it Wallace Shawn? He's the gingerbread man in the Shrek movies, isn't he?
Yeah.
No, somebody else is. Oh.
That's a really terrible and great answer.
Is it Clint Howard?
No, I mean, it's less less like established that guy and more like on the downslope crazy person.
Like a Nick Nolte?
Oh,
or Gary Busey?
There it is. Ding, Gary ding, Busey. Ding. That is
all right.
You're on the right track with Nick Nolte. I figured we were.
He and Gary Busey are basically the same person.
I don't understand why they haven't done something to get like a buddy cop kind of thing.
How great would that be?
The best idea possible.
It would go 4 months over schedule, cost twice the budget. Like it would be a disaster.
Yes. Had you not gotten that, my next clue is going to be chiclets for teeth. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I get that. Yeah.
I feel like we're learning a lot. We have this new buddy cop movie, and we know that Claire Higgins from Hellraiser looks like Jimmy Fallon in drag.
Really, really does. Like really a lot. Yeah.
Just like really a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're switching gears a little bit here. This is, get ready, this is the tricky stuff. Mm-hmm. Question 19, I don't know. What movie sounds better to you? So there's no right answer, I guess.
Okay.
Or no wrong answer.
Well, I bet I can give you a wrong answer, but go ahead.
Based on the title, My World Dies Screaming or Terror in the Haunted House.
My World Dies Screaming or Terror in the Haunted House. My World Dies Screaming is definitely better.
It absolutely is the better title.
That is objectively a better title.
100 points, but they are the same movie.
Are they really?
Yeah, this was if you can guess how people did this, they actually switched the name from the better name to the crap generic name.
Of course, like they always do, yeah.
So the follow-up question here is, what decade was My World Dies Screaming released in?
Well, now here I have cheated. I was curious. I began to look it up, and so I see that it came out in 1958.
Yeah, you are the worst.
If I hadn't known that, I would have guessed it was 60s, because it sounded to me like one of those like Hammer horror film kind of things.
You know, I was going to say that, or it sounds like a 90s, 2000s thing, because it sounds like a My Bloody Valentine song.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It sounds like Fall Out Boy is headlining for My World Dies Screaming.
I can see that, yeah.
Hey, but I have to say that your honesty saying that you looked this up actually makes your earlier plea that you weren't cheating seem legitimate.
See, that's what happens. Scott, when you're just an honest person, then people will trust you.
So this is interesting. I don't know if you saw this while you were looking it up, but My World Dies Screaming used something called Psychorama.
All right.
This is a filmmaking technique. The question is, what was the technique? Psychorama. What does that make you think of?
Psychorama. Some kind of gimmick where, like, in the theater, like a bat would fly down out of the ceiling or something. Is it something like that where, like, an actual thing would be in the theater?
No. Like, what?
All right.
Does
it just mean, like, widescreen?
No, that's...
Or color?
It was actually... I don't know if it was in color or not. It's on YouTube. And I watched some of it earlier, and the fact that I don't remember whether it's black and white or in color is... telling.
All
it's
right.
Very melodramatic, but what is what is Psychorama?
Psychorama makes me think that it's
that a madman came through the theater and murdered people while it was playing.
Or that the movie is made to look like it's all from the point of view of a psycho person
I like that actually. Like not a psycho vision, but a psychorama.
Yeah.
I like that. Because VistaVision it's done where you're looking at the movie from the top of a mountain.
Right, right. So,
but this is really fascinating to me. Psychorama was actually a technique where they used subliminal messaging in the movie.
Oh.
And they used the image of a snake to make you hate someone. They used hearts for love. They wrote in big, big letters the word blood for fear response.
Interesting.
And then only one other film used it, the 1959 movie A Date with Death.
Huh.
And so I don't know that the technique was all that successful at all. Probably not.
Well, and probably if they kept doing that, because later is when people started to get worried about subliminal messages. Like there was that whole thing in the 80s where people were afraid that advertisers were using it and it became this big thing.
But I don't know. So, I mean, were they though? I mean, I don't know that they were. Was it like a razor blade in the candy kind of thing?
No, I feel like there were some actual examples of it and then a lot of imagined things.
Yeah.
There's no way they would have let people do it in movies. People would have been in an uproar.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of funny to look back on it and think, wow, in 1958, this company made this movie where they were very honest, like, yeah, we put one frame in there.
Wow.
But I guess it didn't work because you would assume that if people were responding really viscerally to this film based on the subliminal messaging, that it would have been a hit, that it would have been a really like strong, like, oh, I loved that movie.
Yeah. But if all they're doing is using those subliminal messages as cues to tell you what you're supposed to think of the character, you should be able to pick up on that anyway. Like you should pick up on what the movie thinks you should think of the character.
Like maybe they forgot to do that as far as they were like, we're
that was
only.
All they did. All they did was use subliminal messages. Yeah. It didn't take. People did not catch on.
We're solely using subliminal messages. If you really want your mind erased, watch because it's on on a weekly basis.
Go on.
It's on YouTube, and I will say I don't know the legality of this. I just know that it's on YouTube right now. But you can search for My World Dies Screaming on YouTube. You can watch it on YouTube, and then go watch Psycho and recognize that it's made 2 years apart. And
are they similar?
No, they are. It is really just your mind will be blown in the way that how could two films be so dissimilar in technique and stature?
Like sort of how am I and Naomi Watts members of the same species?
Like yeah, because you're incredibly handsome.
Exactly. So. Exactly. I'm a leggy blonde, and
she's a bearded podcaster.
Mm-hmm, exactly. It's in black and white, by the way, in case you were curious. Terror. My World Dies Screaming on YouTube is in black and white.
Yeah. But you're just going to watch it for the rest of the show now.
If
the rest of it seems phoned in, then that was it. Well, the good news for you is that you have time to watch the movie.
I'm watching a movie. Scott, hush, I'm watching. Just kidding. Go ahead. Yeah, my full undivided attention.
I can tell that you're not actually watching that movie because you're not texting right now at the same time.
That's true.
And no one's calling 911 on you for texting. No, I was going to say you actually can watch the movie if you want because that was the final question.
Oh, there you go.
Did it seem anticlimactic? I can come up with another one like real quick maybe. And just
No, it wasn't anticlimactic. It was a good ending because we had a good discussion. And,
true.
That's all right.
Well, really ruin the climax by adding one more question on then now that we've had
okay
so this is like most horror movies this is where the bad guy comes back unexpectedly.
Oh right.
It's a twist.
We thought the game was over, but no, it's never over.
I have this in the script, I swear. It's not just me like vamping. My question is this: when it comes to horror films, what's like a specific fear that you — this is not a trivia thing, this is just a personal getting to know you kind of question. Mm-hmm. What's the fear that you respond to the most in horror film?
That is a good question. The thing that makes me the most uncomfortable is the fear of pain.
Okay.
Like if someone's in a situation where they are about to be tortured or could be tortured or where it seems like something painful is going to happen, mm-hmm. that is what makes me grip my armrest and hard to watch. Just right. that anticipation of something very painful happening.
Mm-hmm. So like a hostile or you have to saw your own leg off kind of thing.
Those kind of things. Yeah, that gets me. And then the actual deed usually doesn't get me too bad, but it's the thinking about it, the dreading that it's about to happen.
That's interesting. Does that happen with you in like action movies too? Where like, I mean, we mentioned Old Boy as part of the characters being pushed to the edge, but like the hammer sequence, like when he pulls the dude's teeth out, is it just like...
Oh, man. I mean, really the thought of it about to happen is worse than actually seeing it happen.
Way worse. Although there are a couple of like quick edit stuff that people are doing, because like even what was the little Teeth Fairy movie? Don't Be Afraid of the Dark that came out.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The remake that came out, which was another great situation because people are always saying like, don't remake the great movies, remake the bad ones. And everyone's like, oh, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. It's such a cult TV classic. And you go watch it again. You're like, holy Jesus, this is not good.
Yeah, come on. Yeah,
But even that, like the opening sequence of that, they like have the, you know, the dude is tricked the maid down into the basement and he's got the file up against her teeth.
Yes, that's right.
And they smash cut from him raising the hammer. And you see him he gets halfway down and then it cuts to the title scene and it's just like the worst thing possible that they could have done.
Very effective. I do remember that.
Although I guess you could argue Old Boy is kind of a psychological horror film.
Yeah.
But that's an argument for another time.
Let me know when that time is.
I will. It's going to be next Tuesday at 9:57 a.m. And Eric D. Snyder, thank you so much for coming on and filling in the big shoes of Jeff LaTulip. And will you remind everyone one more time where they can... experience you on the internet. I should really write the outro and just read it from a script.
You can get the full Eric D. Snyder experience at Twitter at Eric D. Snyder, Snyder with an I. My own site, ericdsnyder.com, and then I'm at complex.com and Geek Nation and moviebs.com is the podcast that I co-host. I think those are all the places right now.
All the places. And
all the places.
If you haven't read Eric's Bad Movies entries, are they all on your site now?
They're not on my site. They're all archived at film.com where they used to be. Mm-hmm. And then I did a few for Geek Nation and then I sort of got burnt out. I haven't written one in several months.
But the good news for all of you is that
they're all cataloged at film.com. Yeah, if you just search Eric's Bad Movies
If you haven't read them before, then prepare to lose 2 or 3 days straight. They're very funny.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Scott.
And I appreciate you coming on.
It is absolutely my pleasure.
Adi Shankar is the youngest producer to have an indie film hit number one at the box office. He earned that distinction by forcing Liam Neeson to fight wild beasts in the gray, but he's also produced Dread, Killing Them Softly, and a host of bootleg-style superhero films featuring high production value and characters he can't legally make money off of. His most recent work is Judge Dredd's Super Fiend, an animated series of shorts that you can find at Shankar's YouTube page, and he joins us now. Sir, thanks so much for taking the time out.
Oh, no, dude, totally cool, man. You know what? It's like there's a handful of sites on the internet, and it's like you guys, it's like Colliders, and you guys are part of the community of sites that I visit, and like you guys are part of the fan community. You know what I mean? You grow it, and it's like really cool, and I feel like we all speak the same language. The only time these interviews get exhausting is when it's like when you're talking to someone who doesn't get it.
And you're talking to the ninth person in a row who doesn't get it, and has the same question.
And then you're like really sad, and they're like. They're like, so, how are you going to monetize? So I'm like, okay.
People ask you that? That's an interview question?
I'll end up going on a rant about how, like this is supposed to be an art form, so the fact that we're so focused on money all the time and, like, opening weekend and box office and like, the fact that that's even an acceptable interview question is crazy to me.
I mean, I'll admit I get sucked into it too from time to time. And when I do, I find myself remembering, one, I'm not an expert on those things in any way. But two, like it's become so pervasive that like it feels like a natural question.
Right, exactly. But it's weird. It's almost like the thing that stupid like record I have, the youngest dude to have a number one movie, right?
Yeah.
Okay. That's like really stupid if you think about it. Like, why is that even relevant? Like, why is being number one at the box office? Because at the end of the day, you could cheat that, right?
Right.
Like,
and
like
people do.
In a sense that, like, that has no bearing on quality. It has no bearing on actual cultural impact. It has no bearing on anything. Literally, the only thing it has bearing on is theater count and P&A spend.
Right. But it can, right? I mean, it can for some movies be the door opener for a producer or a writer or director. Maybe less a writer, but a director or producer. You could say a bigger fish might come along with more money in their pockets for you. So
exactly. And it's, you know, it's like we as a society have kind of congregated around this notion of the number one movie of the weekend as like a trophy, kind of like we have a lot of these like little trophies and little like victories, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm. People like success. I mean, they gravitate toward it and they assume that is a mark of success, even though a lot of studios are now forcing their way to number one with blunt force and not anything in particular. It's clever about how they're getting people to the theater, but
exactly. And that's what I find weird, you know? It's more now about saving face than...
Right, yeah. No, that's a good way to put it, because you pump an extra $100 million in ad money for the movie that you know is going to just drop 70% the second week because it's terrible, and you know it.
I know, and it's really, you know what, it's perpetuating this culture of, like, disingenuous, you know, hey, we're going to... It's really just perpetuating the consumerist mosh pit. Really, that's what it's doing. It's like putting us in a cycle, and then kids read that story and go, oh...
This is how it's done.
Well, if you're number one, that means you're best, so I got to be, you know, it's like winning at all costs. That's really what it's saying.
Yeah.
Really interesting, you know, when you think about it in the context of, like, just where we've come as a... Or where America's come as a country.
Well, and specifically...
Well, actually, you know, I think it's more of like a global epidemic at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so, too. But at the same time, I was also going to thank you for making R-rated movies and recognizing that maybe that's part of what's happening with the shift in culture right now, is that there's maybe a necessity to make these kind of movies, be purposeful about making R-rated movies.
Yeah, thanks, man. I wish they did better.
Do you see them as an endangered species?
Oh yeah, very much so.
I mean, okay, so my follow-up question to that isn't why, because I think we've already outlined that a bit, just kind of casually, but how strange is it seeing every superhero in existence dominating spring and summer screens while kind of in this PG-13 safety wrapping?
It's actually not that weird, you know? It's really not that weird to me, because most, you know, if you really just go back, right, if you go back in time, like, DC Comics was for fucking little kids, you know?
Right.
And then Marvel, like, with Fantastic Four, their whole marketing point was like, no, we're cooler because we're for teenagers.
Right, more mature.
Right, you know, but at the same time, you're still talking about teenagers, that's still PG-13. Right. The whole R-rated comic book thing, you know, that was an underground movement, that didn't, you know... That didn't really start till the late 80s in a more mainstream way. And even like the characters that we associate as kind of part of that quote unquote R-rated universe, like Ghost Rider, Spawn, Deadpool, Wolverine, Venom, Punisher, you know, they were for the most part presented in a PG-13 manner, mm-hmm. until they were reinterpreted. I mean, even Batman, right? Classic example.
I guess my silver lining question is whether or not, as more movies come out and as superhero movies just continue to be popular in the mainstream, it's not like we see, you know, we assume Spider-Man is going to go R the next outing in any way, but do you think that there is room for growth in that zone in a way that maybe imagine in 2 years you put out another Dread movie, for example, and it's even, you know, it gets even bigger than it was because there's a kind of evolution for R-rated superheroes as well, alongside the kind of the coattails of this gigantic, you know, blockbuster PG-13 superhero phenomenon?
I don't actually see that happening. Mm-hmm. I think the movie-going audience is fragmenting just like anything else, right? I really don't see that happening. I mean, look, I don't... You're talking to someone who doesn't think the movie business is going to be around in 5 years.
Right.
Is it? And I actually believe that. You know, whenever I can't say that around movie people because they get sad and then take it out on me, but...
Well, no one's going to listen to this interview at all. It's just us, so it's fine.
But I don't think the movie business is going to be around in 5 years, or at least not in the way that we think of it.
Yeah. I mean, I can see the inclination there, and I would tend to agree with you in a minor way, which is to say that I think that the studio system, if it doesn't face a kind of existential crisis, will continue to be more and more narrow-minded when it comes to blockbusters only, and will look to people like you and other independent filmmakers and YouTube and Vimeo for other content that we want to see.
Right, and then that you know, the problem is now, so now we're really just talking about semantics, right?
Right.
Because it's how we define movie. We as a society have defined movie as something between you know, 90 and 120 some odd minutes, right? You know, the moment it goes off the platform of the theater, I mean, is it really still a movie? I mean, all these movies that are going day and date, right? Like, they're kind of made for TV at this point.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And calling, like, Netflix series TV shows and having them up for Emmys. Like, what is the difference? The box,
right,
that you view
it in
is the
box. At the
end
of the day, like, the problem is we are, you know, we're using words from a completely different era, from a different context, from a different generation. We're trying to reverse engineer, retrofit those words to apply to today. Mm-hmm. When the truth is, if we were starting, you know, if we were building all this from scratch, we would not define anything the way it's defined today. Everything would have its own, you know, its own definition because ultimately, you know, the movie, the PG-13, everyone in the world is going to know about the script for 5 minutes, and hopefully more, blockbuster has very little in common with, you know, the Sundance movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we call them both movies.
It's funny, you've actually tapped into a common point of grief for a lot of movie critics, is that, you know, we give, let's say, The Gray an A, for example, and then we give Avengers an A, and we give Liberal Arts, Josh Radnor's movie that was at Sundance, we give it an A, and these are all just examples. And then you have people in the comment section that are saying, I can't believe you gave this movie an A, but you didn't give Guardians of the Galaxy an A. You gave it a B minus or something. And it's like, well, how are we even... I mean, when we contextualize our judgments here, you have to keep it within the scope of what this movie is attempting to do and whether it does it well.
100%. You know, before I decided to become a crazy person and run off and try to make movies, I was actually teaching branding at my university, and one of the big principles I would always talk about is this idea of divergence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we always talk about, oh my God, all these devices are going to come together, but that's not really true. Like, if that were true, then, you know, we would have... then people wouldn't buy conditioner and shampoo. They would buy the one that's both of them combined, right?
Right.
Then the toothbrush that also dispenses toothpaste would sell more than any toothbrush.
Right.
It's not true. It's kind of like the All-American Diner. Things just get complicated. They fragment more, right? So we had the All-American Diner back in the day that had burgers, hot dogs, milkshakes, ice cream, pizza, right? Everything. Then the pizza section becomes Pizza Hut. The ice cream section becomes Baskin-Robbins. The burger section becomes Burger King. And things just specialize. And then within the burger, you have high-end burgers, you have low-end burgers, you have frozen burgers. Same thing for pizza, right? And after a certain point, like, yeah, they all owe their lineage to this All-American Diner. But, you know, if you're comparing Haagen-Dazs to Pizza Hut, you're really just, like, what are you talking about? Yeah, they're both food, but you're talking about two completely... you know, disparate categories.
Right.
Kind of how I look at the movie business or what we're calling the movie business. It's diverged so much even in the last 5 years that we're literally calling everything the same thing, but they couldn't be more dissimilar.
Right. It's hard to mentally catch up. I mean, I find myself in this audience as well, but, you know, you have an audience from time to time that looks in and says, Haagen-Dazs, what a terrible pizza.
I think the real problem is you have people that want a high-end hamburger,
mm-hmm.
but they're being told, like, yeah, you should go eat there, and they show up, and they show up to the pizza place. And it's a really nice pizza place, but it's not the burger that they wanted.
I love this analogy. I think we should keep going as long as possible. But I will say my challenge to you with all of this, especially a kind of predictive model where Hollywood, as we know it, or filmmaking, let's say, as we know it, does not exist in 5 years. You echo this a similar sentiment in an interview you did a while back, and I'm quoting here, you can do this as a student, you can do it as a parent, you can do it from some jails. The internet is utterly democratic. For the first time in history, we aren't beholden to hackneyed middlemen looking for a cut, or worse, creative control. My challenge is, my question is, why are we still waiting for this to happen? Why are we still waiting for this to matter, or at least reach a tipping point where we do go to the internet regularly as a source for narrative filmmaking and not just videos where a guy runs over his son's video games with a lawnmower?
I think it's already happening. You know, it's happening on a smaller scale, you know? Mm-hmm. But again, like, you know, if you're saying, like why aren't 90-minute movies being released on the internet? Well, it's a branding issue, right? Because automatically someone's gonna go and say, oh, well, it wasn't good enough to get a theatrical.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. So is it just a generational issue? I mean, is it the kind of thing where we just have to introduce this kind of idea toward a new generation that grows up with the concept that putting a 90-minute, 120-minute movie online has no stigma, no negative sense to it?
Or no. I think the problem is, right, I think, just as a, from on a species level, we suffer from, you know, it's the reason we're all brand whores ultimately, right? Because we suffer from this fundamental need for taxonomy, right? Mm-hmm. So it's literally, I think it's literally as simple as people making 45-minute movies and putting them online for sale. Mm-hmm. Because then all of a sudden it's acceptable. I mean, I've talked about this all the time. I'm like, I mean, we should just coin a word. The word should be featurette because that's actually what the word is, but DVDs have stolen that word. But it used to be featurette, but we should create a word and then make movies, not call them movies, call them something else, coin that word in the same way that, like, you know, Apple doesn't call their iPad MacBook Pad or MacBook, you know, MacBook no keyboard.
Right. Yeah.
That, you know?
Yeah.
It's like you're creating your own category. It's kind of like, you know, the best analogy I can give you on this, right, is do you know who was the first energy drink?
You know, I don't.
Most people think it's
Red Bull. Red Bull, yeah.
Right, most people think it's Red Bull, and then they go, oh, it went Red Bull, Monster, then Rockstar, right?
Right.
Well, actually, the first energy drink came into existence in the mid-80s. It was called Jolt.
Oh, okay, yeah, Jolt Cola, of course.
Yeah, exactly, Jolt Cola. They called themselves a cola because they were like, no, we're a highly caffeinated cola. It's like, no, just call yourself something else. Like, don't use the word cola because now you're competing with Coke and now you're a poor man's Coke.
And they had a picture of a coffee cup or a little icon of a coffee cup on it for even more confusion.
Exactly. Then Red Bull comes around. They call themselves something completely different. They're like, no, we're an energy drink. You can get Coke or Pepsi. Let them duke it out. But you get us because we're our own thing. And that's kind of what we need for the online video space. You know what I mean? Like, you know, in a lot of ways, I think maybe, you know, I touched on this in Comic-Con. I guess someone asked me, like, you know, how difficult is it getting actors to be in your bootlegs? And, you know, and I said, I don't mean this in a douchey way. And it's like, I'm literally just reaching out to friends. And my underlying philosophy is if I can't put them together, you know, easily with relative ease, it's just not worth it because it means that there's something wrong. And that wasn't a philosophy until I started getting incoming calls from agents being like, oh, so-and-so wants to be in your next bootleg. Mm-hmm. And then it dawned on me, well, okay, the reason that's happening is because I'm not calling it a web video, I'm not calling it a fan film, because it's not, it's its own thing, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's another good point. I mean, the calling, we've had people that submit stuff to us that are saying, hey, I'm making this a fan film, but don't call it a fan film, because it's not, and that'll hurt it. And the reality is that the production value is high. And when you hear a fan film, you think, I shot this over the weekend with no money and I'm an amateur and it looks terrible, frankly.
I mean, I've gotten some insane press coverage on this. This Dread thing, which is a fan film.
But it's a high quality fan film. I mean, you have to find a different way to phrase that. Or, I mean, this is your Haagen-Dazs pizza is, you know, different. We think a fan film is an outstretch of fan fiction, which is typically awful.
It's awful. It's awful until it becomes its own thing, like 50 Shades of Grey.
Right, and you have recognizable faces to it too, which add a level of gravitas, or at least respectability. And I would argue that the dearth of roles for actors in bigger movies and a kind of destruction of the stigma of being in television or being in short films or doing other things at the same time as trying to be a feature actor has really, like, flooded the indie filmmaking scene with a lot of new options of people. And probably you're also plugged into a group of people who are just cool and say, yeah, you want to make a... I mean, Joe Lynch, cool as shit. Let's go make this movie. Let's just make it happen.
Right, exactly. So. I have another bootleg that is in post right now. Can't wait for some shows. The World, like, that was the same thing. Just, like, just happened, you know?
Yeah. So, okay, I want to get back to the branding thing. It really involves the kind of movies that you gravitate toward, or at least a theme that I have noticed, and you can correct me if I'm way off base here, but it seems to me that a lot of movies, and we'll use The Gray as an example, are one thing that are disguised as another. And here is where our like love of taxonomy comes into play. With The Gray, it was told to me, even by critics who had seen it, that it was basically the Liam Neeson Fighting Wolves movie. But you have to go watch it to really know what it's about. That was what it repeated all over the time. Liam Neeson wolf movie, Liam Neeson wolf movie. And then, of course, it is just a completely different experience.
Yeah, yeah, no, but I think you know, just, again, going back to, as we're talking about, it's weird. We're talking about film, but we're really just talking about branding at this point, right? Like, you know, The Gray had that iconic shot of Liam fighting the wolf right at the end, or about to have a showdown with the wolf with the bottles and everything, right? And then... And really, at the end of the day, if you just boil it down into a word,
yeah,
wolf movie. Like that's when you have a powerful brand.
I mean, so, it makes things difficult, though, in a way. I mean, this is all challenging. You're working against human psychology to make something that's not high concept. You know, to make something that is. I mean, my question, I guess, is this: like, do you feel that disguising a movie in that way is perhaps the only or the best possible way to get it to a larger audience than would normally see a drama about a man surviving?
100%. I mean, a million percent, yeah. Because, mm-hmm. you know, especially if you're going for that theatrical release thing, then, yeah, that's what you need. You know, you've got to kind of boil something down to the lowest common denominator.
Yeah.
Now, once you're talking about, like kind of more of an art house specialty thing, then I guess there's more, you know, more room to play with stuff. But, you know, movie stars don't exist. Mm-hmm. They don't really matter, right?
Yeah.
It comes down to concept and reviews, really.
I just wonder, I mean, isn't that part of the problem, though, too, ultimately? That you are forced into doing something like that, and then you have people going to the pizza place who wanted a high-end burger and not getting what they were advertised?
I think that's kind of the dilemma of being an in-between generation,
yeah.
Right? Because marketing hasn't really caught up. Movie marketing has not really caught up with where technology is and where people's minds are at, right? At some point, movie marketing will get so good that it'll become incredible. I don't mean movie marketing. Entertainment marketing will get so good. It'll effectively be able to almost perfectly align content with its consumer. Right, like it's like the Netflix recommendation thing on crack.
Right.
It's gonna be like, hey, I don't like romantic comedies. Great, you're gonna love this romantic comedy. What? I don't want to watch romantic comedy. And you start watching, you're like, oh my god, I love that. I don't know why. And the machine knows why. Like it's that kind of shit.
The machine knows. It's a terrifying future.
I don't even think it's that far in the future. That's the thing, you know. Like we're basically living in a sci-fi dystopia.
I will not argue against that in any way. It has already come. The future was yesterday.
Yeah.
We ended up talking about box office and branding and marketing as it has slipped into the conversation, as it does. This is what happens. I will say I love talking to you. I love your passion. I love talking to people who are driven and want to get shit done. Will you come back and talk to us in 5 years once the new future comes to pass?
And then we could be like, oh my God, remember that conversation we had where we talked about Skynet and then it actually happened?
Yeah, exactly. Or will you come back on the show a year from now and say, hey, remember when I thought it was only going to take over 5 years?
Yeah, but at that point, you guys will have a, you know, a Film School Rejects app. and yeah, you'll probably be video-based. And then you'll be like, so Addy, why are you wearing face paint? And be like, it's actually war paint.
But we're still going to say that we're on air.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Addy Shankar, thank you so much for taking the time out. I know that you are hustling right now, and hopefully we can talk to you again soon.
Yeah, man. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
In just a few minutes, I will reveal my hero of the week, but first I want to tell you our interstitial music is from David Rosen, opening and closing theme from the band Party Bats. Our announcer is Dave DeAndrea, art designed by Jen Lindemann at iCandyArt. Show is written by me, Scott Beggs, and Jeff LaTulip. Special thanks to Eric D. Snyder for filling in this week, and Eddie Shankar for being our guest. Our executive producer is Neil Miller. And my hero of the week is all of you who dress up for Halloween. thank you for keeping the dream alive. And if you show up to a door wanting candy and you aren't dressed up in a costume, get off my porch. For everyone at Broken Projector, I'm Scott Beggs, reminding you that the plaque for alternates is in the ladies' room. And if Jeff were here, he would want you to know that he's just a big, soft, cuddly teddy bear. We'll see you next Friday.